Hello and welcome to NewsHour. It's coming to you live from the BBC World Service studios in London. I'm Tim Franks. It's 6 a.m. in the South Korean capital Seoul, and it has been quite the night. It all began at 10:45 in the evening with a surprise appearance on TV by the President, Yoon Suk-yeol, to declare martial law.
친애하는 국민 여러분, 저는...
Dear citizens, I hereby declare martial law to protect the Republic of Korea from the threats posed by North Korean communist forces. To eradicate in one sweep the shameless pro-North anti-state forces that are plundering the freedom and happiness of our people, and to safeguard the constitutional order of freedom.
And that sudden announcement of the imposition of martial law precipitated the most remarkable constitutional standoff between President and Parliament. And the President, just an hour or so before we came on air, appeared to be the one to blink and back down. This is what Mr. Yoon had to say on TV.
존경하는 국민 여러분, 저는 어제 밤 11시를 기해...
Dear citizens, last night, to start at 11 p.m, I declared martial law with firm resolve to save the nation in order to counter anti-state forces seeking to paralyze the essential functions of the state and dismantle the constitutional order of liberal democracy. However, just a short while ago, the National Assembly demanded the lifting of martial law, and I have ordered the martial law command forces to be withdrawn. Through a cabinet meeting, I will immediately accept the National Assembly's request and lift martial law.
So that was just after 4:30 in the morning, South Korea time. Let's whisk you back to earlier in the night. Swiftly, after the President's initial declaration, the focus switched to the seat of Parliament, the National Assembly. That was the thick clatter of military helicopters over the assembly building, while at ground level a large number of protesters gathered, some of whom were involved in clashes with the police. That chant of abolish the martial law. Inside the National Assembly, past midnight, into the early hours, almost two-thirds of the 300 assembly members had gathered in an emergency session. And soon enough, opposition MPs, who have a big majority in Parliament, along with some members of the President's own party, voted to block the imposition of martial law. The Speaker of the House, Woo Woon-sik, announced the result of the vote.
I declare that 190 MPs were present, and all 190 voted in favour of a motion demanding the lifting of emergency martial law.
Among those members of Parliament inside the chamber was Hong Ki-won. He's with the main opposition Democratic Party. And at just gone 2 a.m, his time, we managed to get through to him. As I say, he was inside the chamber of the National Assembly. This then is the story of his night, or rather the first few hours before the President changed his mind. First, how did he hear the news that the President had declared martial law?
At the time, I was sleeping at home, and then my wife woke me up and then informed me that the President declared the state of emergency.
So what did you think when you heard the news that martial law had been declared by the President?
My first thought was that it is not real. It is not possible. I just left my house heading to the National Assembly in Seoul because our party requested all the National Assemblymen come to the National Assembly.
Right, so you got dressed very quickly and you raced off to the Parliament.
Yeah.
And how easy was it to get into the Parliament?
Not easy, very difficult. When I arrived at the gate of the National Assembly, the door was closed, so I tried to cross over the fence of the National Assembly.
What, and you climbed over the fence to get in?
Yes. I climbed over the fence and then crossed over, and then I went into the National Assembly with the help of people. There were many citizens to protest the declaration of the martial law, and then some of the people helped me climb the fence of the National Assembly, and then I succeeded in coming into the National Assembly.
Goodness gracious. So listen, you're... Now that you're inside the National Assembly,
Inside the main chamber of the National Assembly.
Okay, you're speaking to me from the main chamber. So just tell me what the scene is like at the moment. Is it calm? Are people now, talking? Or what's going on?
Yeah, just calm and then waiting and talking. Just about 1 hour ago, we passed the resolution to request the lift of the martial law. And then we are waiting for the president to lift the martial law.
And are you saying that you're going to wait as long as it takes?
Yes. The speaker requested just after the passing of the resolution, all the military men leave the territory of the National Assembly. And then also request the police to open and then let the people come inside the National Assembly area.
Now, from what I understand, there were about 190 or so members of parliament.
We attended at the time.
Right. And just to be clear, you're a member of the opposition, but you're a member of the largest party in parliament. Were there also members of parliament there from Mr. Yoon, the president's party,
ruling party. Yeah, there were also MPs of the ruling party. And then all of them also crossed for the lifting resolution.
Yeah. And have you talked to members of the People's Power Party, the president's party? I mean,
Yes, I did.
So what do they think is going on with the president?
They also have a similar thinking. They also do not understand why the president declared the martial law. They totally did not understand. They did not have any information about the situation.
Yeah. What do you think he's going to do? I mean, do you think even if he lifts martial law now, do you think he can remain as president?
Not for a long time. We think that this declaration of the martial law is the violation of the constitution and also the act of the martial law. The declaration does not meet the requirements of the constitution and the act of martial law.
So, in other words, you think you may impeach the president?
Yeah. I think there is no way. Yeah.
How strong do you think democracy is in South Korea at the moment? I mean, the country's had democracy for more than 30 years. Is it strong enough to survive?
I think so, even though the politics in Korea is divided very sharply. But on this matter, I think most of the people have the same thinking. In Korea, the democracy is very solid. We will overcome the situation and then we'll go forward.
Well, it's amazing to speak to you at 2:15 in the morning in the chamber of the parliament. I mean, you're not sounding tired at all. You're sounding like you're prepared to have a long night and take as long as it needs.
How can I be tired at this kind of situation? Yeah, I am very alert.
That was the South Korean MP Hong Ki-won, very alert, as he told me at just gone 2 in the morning. His time, he was speaking to me from the Assembly, and just outside the Assembly now, at gone 6 in the morning, is our correspondent Laura Bicker. Laura, I guess the mood among the crowd who were gathered there, I don't know how many of them are left, but presumably it's now rather euphoric.
Yeah, there's still hundreds of people. You can probably hear the loudspeakers. I'm just trying to move away from them. I mean, it's very, very hard to kind of gauge the mood. There's a lot of people who have brought out noodles, they're eating meat on sticks. It's very celebratory, but it's also one where a lot of questions are being asked. The one question, the first question you heard there, why did he declare martial law? It's very hard to understand because he would never have had the votes in Parliament. As has been demonstrated. Secondly, what happens next? Now, we're already hearing that there might be moves to impeach President Yoon very soon. We're also hearing that the protesters plan to stay, that more protests may be planned for the centre of Seoul. So there will be calls now for his impeachment. He is, as we would say in Scotland, on a sugarly peg. It is difficult to see how he survives politically after this. He is on the brink, as many would say. And I think what is hard for many to accept is that when he accepted that his ruling of martial law had been overruled, it was trite. He didn't seem sorry. He didn't seem to understand the grave declaration that he had been made. So I think that's what the crowd are trying to understand outside the National Assembly here in the early hours of the morning, a new day.
Yeah, and Laura, I mean, you know the country very, very well. It's true to say, isn't it, that, I mean, it comes, his declaration, I mean, whatever one makes of the fact of it and the gamble that he took that has so backfired, I mean, it's born of a sort of a profound frustration in the way politics is currently being done in South Korea, because it just doesn't seem to be working in a way which is helping to answer any of the really deep questions and challenges that South Korea faces.
I think, having observed this over a number of years, where I would trace this back to would be the historic impeachment of Park Geun-hye, President Park Geun-hye, back in 2016. Many will remember over a million people filled Gwanghwamun, the centre of Seoul, holding candles aloft for 18, 19 weeks on end to impeach the president. Now, at that point, she was successfully impeached. She was sent to prison for corruption and bribery, as were other presidents. You know, when it comes to the direct line between the Blue House and the prison, it seems to be like three out of four have been charged, the last four have been charged with corruption. And it seems that prosecution is being used as a political tool. Now, when it comes to President Yoon, he was already on a slim wedge. He had only narrowly won the presidency, for start. He's become deeply unpopular over the last few years, and he's just struggled to get anything done. His back's against the wall, and I think he decided to take drastic action. But why he decided that this drastic action would work is hard to see, because it would not have solved any of the problems that he was facing. So, one, that is hard to figure out. And then, if he knew he was going to fail, if he knew martial law was going to overturn, what did he think would happen next? Of course, there will be moves to impeach him. So it's hard to look at his reasoning. It's perhaps easier to see why he's done it rather than kind of go into the depths of
Laura,
what on earth was he thinking.
Laura Bicker, outside the Parliament chamber in Seoul, thank you very much indeed. And we'll be returning to South Korea before the end of the programme. Also coming up, Sharon Stone, star of the erotic thriller Basic Instinct, tells us how she auctioned a kiss to make money for AIDS.
I'm really proud that I took this idea that was made up in this movie, that I was really sexy, and used it to fight a disease where people were getting punished for their sexuality, because I was getting punished for mine.
More from Sharon Stone in 30 minutes. Main story this hour, as we've been hearing, South Korea is in chaos after President Yoon Suk-yeol declared that he was lifting a martial law order that he'd only announced a few hours before. This is NewsHour. It's live from the BBC in London. I'm Tim Franks. It was, Joe Biden said today, America's original sin. Mr. Biden was referring to slavery, and he was speaking on the first visit in almost 10 years of a US president to Africa. He's in Angola, where, along with trying to build new economic ties and to push back against Chinese and Russian influence on the continent, the president has visited the National Slavery Museum in the capital, Luanda.
Historians believe people from Angola accounted for a significant number of all enslaved people shipped to America. Today, millions of African Americans have roots in Angola. As I said at the U.S. African Leaders Summit that I held in Washington two years ago, our people lie at the heart of the deep and profound connection that forever binds Africa and the United States together. We remember the stolen men and women and children who were brought to our shores in chains, subjected to unimaginable cruelty.
Several million Angolans were enslaved in the Americas. Indeed, some of the first African slaves came from what is now Angola and were taken to the then British colony of Virginia. Mariana Candido is a professor of African history at Emory University in Georgia. What does she make of Joe Biden's visit today?
I think it's extremely important when American presidents visit African countries, particularly Angola, that has a complicated history with the United States in the past several decades, now related to the Civil War that affected Angola from 1960s to early 2000s. So it's good that President Biden is visiting Angola. And it's also important that the conversations are around the importance of Angola in the transatlantic slave trade, because as you probably know, the region of the African continent that lost the largest number of people into the transatlantic slave trade is what is nowadays Angola. It's a region that historians call West Central Africa, which includes Angola, and is the region that lost roughly 5.6 million people. This is the estimated number of people we know who left from West Central Africa, from the ports of Angola, including Luanda, the Angolan capital. So I am very hopeful that all this attention will raise a rare awareness about Angola and the importance of Angola into the transatlantic slave trade. And we not necessarily talk much about what happened to African societies. So to the societies that had to cope with losing so many young and healthy people. Because as you can imagine, these societies saw this demographic loss that affect not only populations, but also affect political organizations, affect economies, affect institutions, affect social organizations. So I am very hopeful that the visit of President Biden and more attention to the role of Angola in the transatlantic slave trade will lead to more important conversations about the consequences for Africans who remained in the African continent.
In terms of Angola itself, I had no idea before I did this interview just how many millions of slaves were transported from and through Angola. I thought it was much more up the west coast of Africa, much further north where the bulk of this terrible trade came. Why do you think it is that Angola has, in a sense, drawn less attention?
I think it has to do with linguistic issues. You know, Angola is a country where Portuguese is the language, is a place that is not necessarily big in the imaginary about Africa. But it's important to recognize that the majority of people enslaved in the African continent left from places in what is nowadays Angola. I think this is very visible in other parts of the world. For example, in Brazil, people are aware of the importance of Angola and the historical connection between slavery in Brazil and the people in Angola. But this is not true in the United States, even though, you know, about a quarter of all enslaved Africans who arrived in the United States came from what we call Angola.
And that was Mariana Candido, Professor of African History at Emory University in Georgia. Life for wolves in Europe, at least, may be about to change. The Berne Convention, which oversees international laws on wild animals, has today accepted or adopted a European Union proposal to lower the protection status of the wolf. The status goes from strictly protected down to just protected. The number of grey wolves in Europe is estimated at 21,000 and growing, thanks to nearly 50 years of strict protection. Wolf attacks on cattle have prompted some farmers, though, to call for action. Nick Thorpe visited the Carpathian Mountains in Romania to talk to those in favour of and against the hunting of wolves.
It's midnight in Transylvania, an almost full moon outside and the first frost of autumn stiffening the grass on the high mountain meadows. Christy Pop, the head of the large carnivore program of the Worldwide Fund for Nature in Romania, is playing me one of his wolf recordings.
In Romania, the wolf is it's a national symbol, actually, because it used to be on the flag of the Dacians.
The indigenous tribe which fought and was eventually overcome by the Romans. Christie contrasts the public image of the wolf with that of the bear, which has a bad reputation at the moment because of bears which raid bins in towns and villages in the mountains. But some farmers in Romania too, as increasingly across Europe, believe wolves should be less protected.
We always feed the dogs at midday, before the milking, and we check to see they're all there. And that's when we noticed Moody was missing, so we knew for sure that was the end of him.
Jozef Radz is a shepherd in the village of Csíkszentmárton, who cares for 500 ewes. From April to November, he spends days and nights with his flock on the upland meadows. He has 17 dogs in all, but the loss of his best herding dog to the wolves last year was a heavy blow.
The trouble with wolves is they're very clever animals compared to a bear. If a bear gets into the enclosure, he might take one sheep. But if a wolf gets in there, he might kill dozens.
Wolf numbers are growing because they're strictly protected. Slovakia is home to about 300, and the government wants to reintroduce an annual cull. But Michal Haring, a Slovak biologist, says wolves do a lot of good by eating wild animals affected by African swine fever. Shooting wolves could actually increase the number of attacks on livestock, he believes.
If you fragment the wolf pack, if it's fragmented to the smaller ones, it's not able to hunt the big prey like red deers and wild boars, and then it's going for the easier prey, which is the livestock, sheep and the cows.
Luxembourg is possibly the only European country where no wolves have been sighted yet, but the authorities are preparing for them. Laurent Schley is head of the Government Department for Wildlife Management.
Especially Western Europe, we have very high densities of deer, wild boar, so the conditions for the wolf are there. Of course, there is some behaviour that cannot be tolerated. Let's say if individual wolves start killing too much livestock, if individual wolves or individual packs were to show aggression towards humans, of course, human safety always comes first.
Across Europe, the wolf has become a bone of contention between rural communities who want more protection from it and activists who welcome the rewilding of the continent.
And that was Nick Thorpe reporting from Romania. You're listening to NewsHour. Welcome back to NewsHour. Think of France and you might imagine a glass of fine wine. It's part of the French way of life. Or at least it has been. There is talk of a crisis in the wine industry because of the changing climate and changing tastes. John Murphy has been to the heart of one French winemaking region to find out what's going on.
The smell. The vine has a special smell when you cut it, and it felt like blood to me, you know.
Marie-Caroline Rosier is standing in a newly ploughed field. Her vines have been pulled up this year. Confronted by unpredictable and destructive weather, she and her sister felt they had little choice.
In 2017, we lost 80% with the frost, and in 2022, we lost everything. A storm of hail just ruined everything.
How big were these hailstones?
They were like that, maybe a golf ball.
From an original 19 hectares here in the Bordeaux region, the family now has just three left, with no intention of planting new vines.
It's extreme, the climate. When it rains too much. When the wind blows, it blows so strongly that it breaks everything.
Sébastien d'Anjou steers his battered 4x4 around his family's vineyards in the foothills of the Pyrenees Mountains in southwest France.
It stopped raining 3 years ago. It's the most important problem we have ever had. Look at the soils. They are dry. Everything is dry.
While the Bordeaux region has suffered from too much rain, as well as frosts, hailstorms and disease, particularly the fungus mildew, Sébastien's corner of France in Languedoc-Roussillon has been parched.
There are some vines which died, so we replace every year.
In fact, here we can see in this field there are lots of ancient-looking vines, but next to them, dotted around, there are these baby little vines.
Yeah. They will adapt themselves if they have time to adapt. The problem is that it's so brutal, the rapidity of this change, that we won't have time to adapt. That's our fear.
What about your particular harvest this year?
A very good quality, but there's not enough. It's 50%.
In some other wine regions, like the Jura, its estimated production is down 70% this year. On top of that, tastes are changing. People are drinking less. Though wine remains the single biggest source of jobs in many rural areas and earns billions in export and tax revenue for the country. But facing a litany of challenges, some winemakers have decided, ça suffit, that's enough.
It wasn't hard for me, it was hard for my mum.
For Marie-Caroline Rosier, there's no way back. Her sister's found a job elsewhere, and she's now trying to keep the family's 15th century chateau going by offering bed and breakfast and hiring it out for functions like weddings. It marks the end of a century of winemaking here.
And that report from John Murphy. You can hear more of what he discovered in France in Assignment here on the BBC World Service and also wherever you get your podcasts. You're with NewsHour. It's live from the BBC in London. I'm Tim Franks. You may have thought, I certainly did think, that since seizing power in Afghanistan 3 years ago, the Taliban had managed to close the space for women, the opportunities for women, pretty comprehensively. They'd stopped women going to university. Indeed, they'd stopped girls going to school beyond the age of 12. They'd banned women from parks, from speaking loudly in public. And so the restrictions piled chokingly one on top of the other. But it clearly hasn't been enough for the Taliban. Today came the edict that women cannot be given any medical training. It was one of the few avenues open to women seeking further education, where they could learn to be nurses or midwives. This in a country which has one of the highest maternal death rates in the world. Selgay Sahar has been a student at the Midwifery Institute in Kabul. At least, she has been until today. This was some of what she had to tell our colleagues at the BBC Afghan service.
I was thinking I just want to die because there is no reason to live. I thought with myself, from now on, I'm going to just sit in my home doing nothing. When I was in institute, I was learning English a few years ago. One day, my classmate told me he was a boy. He said, you could just sit in your home. You're doing a lot to come here. You just struggle so much. And I was thinking, no, home is not my place. Kitchen is not my place. But now I'm thinking, yeah, he was right. This is my place. I feel so bad. I just, now I have to stay all day home doing nothing. I can't even go outside. We have no rights. We can't even ask why is this even happening. Why do they want us to not come to institute? We are in hijab. We're going in hijab. We are protecting our modesty. We know what Islam is. We know our rights. What is the main reason that they're stopping us from education, for gaining something that's our right? I mean, it's really sad. I mean, this is the question that we have to ask. Why? There is nothing to study. I mean, why am I even in this world? I feel like I just want to die. That was my feeling.
The heart-rending words of a student midwife who's just seen her future close down. We've also been hearing from a young woman in the west of Afghanistan who was stopped from going to university 2 years ago. She now secretly teaches English to girls. She was speaking to my colleague, Sarah Montague.
I have a friend, actually two friends. One was studying midwifery, and she was at her last semester. She took her exams, and she was near to graduate. They closed them today morning. And I have another friend. She started to study mental health, and it has been one semester that she was studying. And now, you know, it has been closed.
How have your friends reacted to this news?
You know, they are angry, they are sad, they think they cannot do anything because when they raise their voices, when they say something, Taliban send them to prison.
Right, because women aren't allowed to be heard outside the home.
Yeah.
How does that affect you now? Do you go out?
Yes, I'm a teacher. I teach the girls. You know, when I see them, I think they want to arrest me. Seriously, I think they came to arrest me.
So you're doing it underground?
Yeah. I teach them voluntarily because I don't want them to be illiterate, to become illiterate. I know it is dangerous, but I do it for education, for human right, for humanity, for myself.
A clandestine English teacher in Afghanistan, speaking to Sarah Montague. Sabrina Sakeb is a former member of parliament in Afghanistan. She's now based in Toronto, where she's involved in human rights advocacy. What does she make of the latest edict from the Taliban?
I think, of course, really critical circumstances and consequences for the women of Afghanistan for their health care, especially reproductive health. In Afghanistan, what had one of the highest rate of maternal mortality in the world, with all the international support and presence. Now you can imagine that how the things will change from now on.
I was reading just before this interview that the United Nations agency, which deals with women's health and well-being of women, it said that there was already a shortfall, I think, of 18,000 midwives in Afghanistan. There are currently 17,000 women who are being trained in midwifery and in nursing in Afghanistan. Do you know what is going to happen to them, whether they are going to be allowed to continue?
This new order or restriction is in a reaction to the latest movement outside Afghanistan referring the atrocities and the crimes that Taliban are committing towards the women of Afghanistan to the ICC, International Criminal Court. So I believe this is a reaction towards that. I think women and women's rights are being used as bargaining chip. And Taliban are wisely, you know, using this tool to pressurize the international community to be recognized. And they might ease the restrictions, you know, after a while. So women will be restricted as a like open prison in their households. Even the family members, the male family members who are afraid of being punished because of the demands that women have in their families will be more pressurizing their girls and the women. They'll marry off their girls early to another family because women sitting at home, no work, no income, is a burden on the shoulder of a poor family. And then there will be even more violence by the in-laws' families. Women have no voice over their reproductive health. And the whole purpose of marrying is to bring kids and, you know, build families for male in Afghanistan. And the more you bring, the better, forgetting about the mental health of these women and the trauma that they have experienced. Not only they have not voice over their fate, you know, who to marry, what to study, being banned from work. It's about men and women, the new generation, the next generation of kids who will be, you know, brought up to this world and they will be, you know, under supervision, a mother who is not mentally well. Herself. So you can see the concern is much deeper than only the right to education or the right to work, rather having a society dealing with the consequences of this decision later on.
Sabrina, you've painted a terrible picture of just the sort of ripples that will follow this latest edict, the effect that it will have in such a deep way. I guess, you know, one of the questions people listening to this might be asking is whether there is anything that can be done from outside. I mean, is there any leverage, do you think, for example, Western governments to exert over the behaviour of the Taliban to try and allow a little bit of a small sliver of light for women and girls in Afghanistan?
I think the international shrimp community should consider that every decision that they are making, it's about the life of people on the ground in Afghanistan. They have to listen to the women of Afghanistan and make sure that don't be fooled by the Taliban. It's not only about the right to education. Opening schools is not enough. It's not the end. People are dying from hunger. They are poor. They are afraid. They don't have any means. Still, women are taking to the streets, you know, to raise their voice.
The former Afghan MP Sabrina Saqib speaking to me from Toronto. Filippo Turetta, the 22-year-old Italian student who admitted stabbing to death his ex-girlfriend Giulia Cecchettin last year, has been sentenced to life in jail. The murder case gripped Italy and it sparked a heated debate on not just violence and coercive behaviour against women, but also the broader balance of power between men and women in the country. Last month, the Italian Parliament held what they called a minute of noise in memory of Giulia Cecchettin. MPs pounded their desks and stamped their feet. Ilario Boiano is an Italian criminal lawyer. She's with the organisation Differenza Donna, which works to provide shelters and other support for vulnerable women. How important was today's sentencing for Italy?
We think that today's verdict and the case of the femicide of Giulia Cecchettin is very important because it recognizes the absolute gravity of femicide as a crime. But not only femicide, also the previous continuum of violence that Giulia Cecchettin suffered. People understand now the gravity of psychological violence, coercive control, and all forms of stalking.
And just to be clear about this, is coercive behaviour, that type of psychological violence, is that a crime in Italy?
We can say yes. Legally speaking, we have enough criminal provisions to punish this kind of behaviours. We don't have a specific crime named in this way. Even if the Court of Venice recognises the femicide, the court, it seems, but we have to read the decision, it seems that didn't recognize the previous stalking as a prodromic to the femicide.
It was incredibly striking, wasn't it, when Giulia's sister, Elena, said of the ex-boyfriend, he was not a monster. He was, and I think I'm quoting correctly, he was the healthy son of a patriarchal society.
It was a call on a public responsibility about the Giulia's femicide. We can also say that from our recent research about gender-based violence among the young people, we noticed that this kind of conduct, like control, coercive control, geolocalization of people by the phone, by app, is normalized as a form of love, a form of attention that the partner gives to the other. So in particular, young men to their women partners.
How bad is the problem in Italy? Do you think that the country has a particular issue with gender-based violence?
The last decade of legal reforms had an important impact on protection. The key is to believe women. Women have to face a lot of secondary victimization before courts. And even if it happens that they are killed by the ex-partner, people around them, the family's lawyers, have to demonstrate that she asked for help, that she was in a situation of domestic violence. We have a lot of change to face and to promote in our courts.
The Italian criminal lawyer Ilario Boiano on the work still to be done, even after the conviction and sentencing of that killer of Giulia Cecchettin. This is NewsHour from the BBC World Service. This is NewsHour, live from the BBC. The Hollywood star Sharon Stone has been making a mark on and off screen for more than three decades. She rose to worldwide fame with her role in the 1990s erotic thriller Basic Instinct, starting a career as an A-lister which earned her a Golden Globe and an Oscar nomination. Less is known about the woman beyond the screen, the woman who had a life-altering brain hemorrhage, who lost her fortune and who had to fight to gain back custody of her son. She's now been named one of the BBC's 100 women in the 2024 list following her decades-long philanthropic efforts dedicated to a number of causes. Sharon Stone sat down for an exclusive interview with the BBC's Chichi Izundu to discuss life after her stroke and how Hollywood may finally be waking up to misogyny.
Movies were written, directed, and produced by men. So they were written to be the fantasy of men, and women were playing the fantasy of men, and they were edited to be the fantasy of men, and that was it.
He wasn't afraid of experimenting. I like men like that. Men who give me pleasure.
I think we're getting to a place where women are just playing how a woman would actually behave in this circumstance. Women just don't wake up in the morning and already have their makeup on and have slept in rollers, and reality has seeped into the media. Shock.
When you look back on your body of work, mm-hmm. what's the most proud thing?
So I did this auction. Someone said they wanted to buy a kiss from me. And I got both a man and a woman bidding to buy a kiss, and I got them bidding against each other. Oh. I would say more than anything, if you would ask me about Basic Instinct, that's what I learned from that movie. Mm. Because I got made into an idea of something, and I sold it for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars to raise money for AIDS research. I'm really proud that I took this idea that was made up in this movie, that I was really sexy, and used it to fight a disease where people were getting punished for their sexuality because I was getting punished for mine.
Because you were labeled
sex symbol.
Sex
symbol. The last.
Femme fatale.
The last of the sex symbols.
In the 1990s. You have had some really huge things happen in your life.
Yes, like I have.
The brain hemorrhage that you survived.
Yes.
The things that you fight for, you fight hard for them.
Yes.
As well as keeping good energy around you. What other resilient tactics do you put into place?
I stay present. I think if you look back, you can really F yourself up. It's really hard work.
With your brain hemorrhage, I read that you didn't like the Sharon before, but you love this Sharon.
That Sharon before moved out of a farm town and became a global superstar and might not have exploded if she wasn't met with so much resistance.
And if you could write a letter to yourself, you pick the age.
I would just say, you're going to make it. You're going to make it. I would want it to have known it when I was on the floor and couldn't get an ambulance. I would wanted to have known it when they wouldn't believe me at the hospital, when I kept losing in custody court and I had to remortgage my house and I didn't have any money. But I really learned that people can take everything from you, your job, your family, your health, but they cannot take your soul.
And that was Sharon Stone speaking to Chichi Izundu. Let's go back to South Korea and just try to wrap our heads around an extraordinary night. President Yoon Suk-yeol declaring martial law and then lifting martial law a few hours later. I've been speaking to Jean Lee. She's the former bureau chief of the Associated Press in Seoul. She's now a fellow at the East-West Center in Hawaii, enormously experienced in the region. What on earth has she made of what's happened in Seoul overnight?
Yes, not the news I was expecting to hear when I woke up. When you get a news alert that says martial law, certainly it strikes fear in your heart because you're thinking it has something to do with North Korea. But clearly, this is a South Korean president frustrated by the political paralysis staged, waged by the opposition, and who made what looks like a rash decision to reassert control. But it was very interesting to see. I think at the end of the day, he is a man who does I hope, respect the rule of law and counts on the alliance with the United States, and seems to have come to his senses. So we're now seeing that rule of law play out. But I think that this will have political consequences for days and weeks and months to come.
In what way? I mean, what's your best guess? I mean, presumably it's going to be difficult for him to restore any respect or standing that he has in the office.
So this was a gamble that he took, but you're absolutely right. I think it's going to be very difficult. He was already coming into this incident with very low approval ratings. That was certainly very frustrating for him because it meant that it curtailed his mandate and his ability to carry out his vision for South Korea. So he took this gamble, was perhaps really underestimating the response. But now it will certainly galvanize people who did not like him or opposed to him to rise up together. And we saw that certainly in the streets. So yeah. I think it's going to be a bit of a tumultuous couple of weeks. We may see some more protests. Let's see how things roll out.
Yeah, I mean, given the paralysis that you mentioned, given the polarization, it's a very, very sharp division of rhetoric in South Korea between the main political groupings. And given the depth of the problems that South Korea faces internally, I mean, not to mention the possible threat from the North, do you think that, strangely, this might be one of those events which could somehow tip South Korea into a sort of rather more constructive way of doing politics?
I'm not so sure. I mean, I do think this was a test of their democracy, and this is a moment for them to take a step back. Recognize, of course, that they are a young democracy and that sometimes these authoritarian tendencies do rear up. So it is a moment to look at that. I think they'll be reassured if things play out according to the rule of law. But I think that this division, this polarization is so deeply embedded in South Korean politics, and it is in large part about North Korea. President Yoon was a man of great conviction and had a very strong stance about how to deal with North Korea. The opposition has a very different approach on how to deal with North Korea. And so much of that does determine where your resources go, what your policies are. And so I do think that element of it, at a time when we're seeing North Korea send troops, send missiles, send ammunition to Ukraine, yeah, has been a part of that backdrop.
Jean Lee, former bureau chief for the Associated Press in Seoul, bringing this edition of NewsHour to a close. From me, Tim Franks, and the rest of the team here in London, thanks for your company. Thanks.